Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at theopenhouse.net.au blog site.
This past week, of course, was the week of Australia's worst national disaster. It was also the week that marked the 200th anniversary of Charles Darwin's birth. Now, as you well know, Darwin's theory of evolution has influenced not just science, not just biology and geology, but also things as far-flung as psychology, sociology, ethics, education, the arts, even theology, our understanding of God and the way he works. Now, from a Christian standpoint, the debate rages over whether the earth is young and made in six 24-hour days, as a literal kind of reading of the book of Genesis might suggest, or whether it's millions of years old and God actually used evolution as a tool to create it. Now, to really address those questions fairly would actually require, I think, a year's worth of debates on the scientific evidence, the literature, the purpose of the book of Genesis, and a raft of related topics. So what we're going to do instead tonight is look at how Darwin's ideas have shaped contemporary life, faith, and culture, sometimes even to our detriment. And then we're going to look at a couple of views on how the idea has influenced understandings of Christian faith in particular. So firstly, Dr. Tom Frame. Tom is the director of the St. Mark's Theological Centre in Canberra and the author of many books. We've spoken to him on a number of them. And his latest one is Evolution in Antipodes. Dr. Tom Frame, welcome back to Open House.
Sheridan, good evening to you.
Yeah, it's good to talk to you again. Sketch out for us a history of Darwin's idea, where it caught on, where it didn't, where it found acceptance, how it was originally received after he actually came out and published it.
There's a whole lot of things there together. I'll try and be brief if I can. The first thing that I'd want to say is that ideas of evolution predate Charles Darwin. There'd been much thought about the way in which the origins and forms of life might be best depicted in terms of the evidence that was available. So he picked up an idea which already had some currency, but people couldn't explain how they thought, if they thought, that life evolved. So Darwin began life to some degree a fairly conventional Anglican believer in Victorian England. He had a lot of Unitarian influence on his life. He went to sea on board HMS Beagle, went all around the world, including a brief time here in Australia. He went back to England and tried to make sense of the enormous amount of data that he'd collected over 5 years away. There were specimens, flora, fauna, all to be put together. And he tried, and this was a little bit contrary to the custom of the day, to apply a theory to what he could see. And it wasn't until he read Thomas Malthus's essay on population, how population is affected by the amount of food that is available, and he came to what he called his one long argument in 1844, which eventually he published as On the Origin of Species in 1859, where he argued that all of life was linked. Species were involved in evolution within a species. Those which, were mutated to, and if a particular mutation gave a positive advantage, it was likely to persist. Those that were unfavourable mutations would disappear. And gradually, he said, by a process that he called natural selection, that life would evolve. He actually used the phrase descent with modification was the way he preferred to describe it. Mm-hmm. Now, he published his book in 1859. There was a lot of reaction to it at the time, both from the scientific world and the religious world. And in the remainder of his life, he died in 1882, there was a lot of discussion about the extent to which, one, his theory was an accurate depiction of the origins and forms of life, but secondly, and this I suppose is of concern to us, the extent to which Darwinian theory as it became known could apply to things beyond just biology. That then led to some of the controversies that I suspect we're going to talk about tonight.
Yes. Given the fact that you're not a quote-unquote scientist, at the same time you have applied yourself to look at and investigate the whole history of the idea, including the scientific evidence for it, when you have New Scientist magazine recently come out and say on the front cover, Darwin was wrong, and other kind of things like that, where do you currently see the theory in terms of the scientific community? Are there any areas that are particularly debated amongst the scientific community right now?
Well, what I would say and I suppose it's by way of personal explanation, is that every person has to make judgments about the ideas that are swirling around them. Now, some of them are pertinent and you deal with them directly. Others you say, look, that doesn't really relate to me. I don't think it's important. I'll ignore it. So I've taken the view that I'd heard so much said about Darwin's ideas, the best way to deal with it was to make my own study. Now, I've said I'm not a scientist, but I still need to be persuaded because I need to read the arguments for and against any idea as to whether it's cogent, whether there are genuine questions being asked, whether a theory is in fact a successful one or whether it's flawed. From what I have been able to discern, and I think all listeners need to do this if they're going to take these questions seriously, from what I've been able to discern, Darwin's ideas provided an interpretive framework which still is regarded by the majority of people working in the physical sciences as being a wonderful tool for understanding the current forms of life and where they may have come from. Now, it is the case that there are debates, of course, in any scientific community and within it, about elements of a theory, about how it can be applied, about the evidence for it. But what I am understanding from what I am reading, people generally accept that evolution by natural selection has been the way in which life has evolved. Now, there will be people to say there's a lack of fossil evidence. There will be people to say it jumps over or avoids hurdles which really need to be answered. And some of those hurdles, some of these objections may be so grave that theory collapses. But that's not what I'm seeing from what I am reading. And I've come to the point of view, which is to say that evolutionary theory does give us a handle on understanding the world around us at the moment. And all of the evidence seems to point in the direction of an ancient world in which life has evolved and is still evolving right now.
This is Open House Across the Nation. We're talking about the influence of Darwin's theory, his ideas on life, faith, culture, and indeed on theology, our understanding of God and how he actually works in the world. We'll get a slightly different view in a few moments' time. And I'm interested to know, Tom, you know, the way that you integrate your understanding of the first book of the Bible, Genesis, with your ideas on evolution. We'll talk about that in just a minute. But give us a bit of a sweep as to how the idea has kind of jumped out of science or the physical sciences and then has influenced almost every aspect of life that we actually see. Let's start with the social sciences, psychology, sociology, things like that. How has evolution changed the way we understand those fields?
Well, in the second half of the 19th century, we need to understand, I think, the cultural milieu in which evolution burst onto the scene as Darwin described it. This was a time of great faith in progress, that human society was rapidly developing, that all of its problems would be solved, that with the application of reason there was nothing human beings couldn't understand, no problem that couldn't be resolved. And so the development of social sciences and behavioural sciences looked directly to the kinds of things that Darwin was saying, because many of them wanted to take a totally naturalistic view of the human species. In other words, we're just like animals, just like any other animal, and therefore we're to be studied the same way that you might study rats or mice in a laboratory. And some of them took the view that if you take God out of the equation, remove any element of supernaturalism, and you just apply yourself to phenomena that can be studied, then Darwin was telling us something. For instance, that human beings, if they did evolve from other species, there may be some elements of the human species as we now are, which point to some continuation of parts of the evolutionary process, bits of what we were that persist that are no longer needed now, or bits about our past that might explain how it is or how it was that we behave in particular kinds of ways. Now, it got particularly virulent, I would want to say, in some areas, particularly politics, economics, and in social theory, where people took the view that, well, what nature was saying to us was those who are weak need to be eliminated. They don't help the overall well-being of the species. And so particularly in Melbourne, there are a number of public figures saying prominently those people who are sick and infirm, they really ought not to be helped because they're depleting the human race. And what I would call Spencerism, not social Darwinism as it's sometimes called, Spencerism, coming from the views of Herbert Spencer, survival of the fittest, what people did was take Darwin's scientific ideas to do with the physical sciences, particularly biology, and applied them to fields to which they were not well suited. So it surprisingly became the theory of everything before theories of everything became very popular. And it persisted really into the 20th century. I think, Sheridan, it wasn't really until the Great War of 1914-18, where humanity basically smashed itself to pieces, that people began to think, well, maybe it isn't inexorable, this human progress. Maybe there are times in which human beings do things which are contrary to their self-preservation, and therefore maybe just in terms of the way it's worked out in world events, maybe evolution doesn't describe everything.
Okay, so the idea jumped out and started being applied, in your mind, to areas where maybe it wasn't really supposed to be applied?
Oh, certainly not. I mean, Darwin, I think, would have been horrified if he'd seen the ways in which his theory was being applied, say, to economics. And I think, similarly, he would be surprised that evolutionary psychology, something that I've talked about in my new book, that he would kind of shake his head and say, well, I don't know about the things of which you're talking because they were not my concerns. My theory was about organisms. It was about flora and fauna. It wasn't to do with, if you like, the complex interactions between human beings and all of the factors that bear upon them. And I think that certainly calling these things, you know, various forms of Darwinism is unfair when Darwin himself didn't apply them to these aspects of life.
Okay, how has Darwin's ideas then been applied and therefore influenced our understanding of ethics today?
This is the interesting part. I've been arguing that, to some degree, if those that have wanted to promote Spencerism, as I've tried to suggest, a non-valid way of applying Darwin's theory to the world, these people actually have pretty well been shunned, overlooked, and now there's a sense of cringe about these kind of people who just do think that, for instance, if one of them in the 1870s said with respect to Aborigines and Maoris, well, of course, we had to take their countries from them and appropriate their patrimony, one of them, Henry Keelock Rusden, said, because that's the way that nature means things to be. In other words, ethics needs really to be understood in the context of what is best for the preservation of the best of our species. Now, it hasn't been, if you like, something that's undergirded our ethics, but you still, I think, see resonance of it when people think that really human life is about inexorable progress, that each year will be better than the one before, each society will be more knowledgeable than the one that came before it, and therefore some things are necessary just so that our species will survive. Now, there are many discordant voices now, people who say, for instance, we shouldn't treat animals as we do, we shouldn't treat the environment as we do. Why? Because we're not the most important thing in the natural world. So thankfully, I think that Darwinism has not affected, probably then would rather say Spencerism, in fact, hasn't had the effect on ethics that it might have, and that's a good thing.
And you know, I think of somebody like Peter Singer, who would suggest that, yes, the extremely disabled child probably isn't worth keeping around because of they don't have that kind of utilitarian value on society. Is that not to some degree taking that social Darwinism, that Spencerism, as you call it, down the same path?
I mean, Singer wouldn't come from that particular direction, but there would be some who would share that view. Some people certainly have taken that view in the past, but now we regard it as being totally reprehensible to have that view. What I say to people, though, who, if they do want to take a naturalistic view of things, is where did you get the idea from that we should be compassionate, or that we should be caring, or that we should expend resources on people who are not productive? Where did that idea come from? And if you say, oh, because that's a part of being civilized, well, I would say, well, yeah, but where did that idea come from? Why, if you like, do we do things which don't always and everywhere assist in the preservation of the human species or the survival of the fittest? We don't act that way. We act in ways, in many ways, quite contrary to what nature might seem to dictate.
Yes. Well, I wanted to raise that, actually, and that's your comments have just led me straight there. This week alone, we have seen some of the biggest outpourings of generosity that we've seen in many a year. People taking in strangers into their home and helping out the young and the vulnerable and the aged and helping people to get through Victorian fires that have actually taken so many lives. They've gathered together and they've pooled their resources. Businesses are giving their goods and services for free. It would seem to me that the survival of the fittest isn't working here. It's actually the support of the weakest, that, you know, there's an altruism that comes that I don't think Darwinism, as taken in ethical terms, actually accounts very well for.
Well, one of the things I've talked about in my book and really in the context of evolutionary psychology is inadequate depictions, in my view, within evolutionary psychology of altruism, of actually explaining it. Now, Very often what people have done in this particular context is talked about group natural selection. In other words, what we're actually doing is rather than trying to preserve ourselves as individuals, we try and preserve ourselves in communities. This idea has been around in the 1920s. So some people may counter what you have said, and I would share your view, but some people may counter what you have said by saying, well, there's also group natural selection. In other words, that groups of people come together so that whole societies get wiped out because stronger whole societies, which have a better sense of group cohesion, are able to, persist when conditions are difficult and sometimes antithetical to their survival. So if you want to take the approach that there is no God and we simply have to look around the world and make sense of it, then there are some contortions that are sometimes Christians are accused of. There are contortions, though, that evolutionists do sometimes have to deal with if they are wanting to be true to the principles that life is only what we make it in a very arbitrary sense.
Mm. This is Open House Across the Nation. How have Charles Darwin's ideas affected life, faith and culture? That's what we're talking to Dr. Tom Frame about. His new book is called Evolution in Antipodes. Okay, just briefly then, Darwin's influence on education, politics and the arts.
Well, if I could take, first of all, say, if we look at education, I mean, it's not so much Darwin's direct influence on education, but his ideas and teaching them in schools. We know that this has been, in the United States, an explosive issue. It really came to the fore in the Scopes trial, the so-called Tennessee monkey trial of 1925, where the issue turned on whether or not evolution could be taught in American classrooms. Now, there have been a number of cases since then about creation science, certainly whether or not evolution as taught in schools was contrary to what some people believe was taught in the Bible, and therefore some school districts in the United States didn't want evolution taught. These cases have continued. We've never had them in Australia because in Australia, schools, even if they're funded with public money, are able to teach creation science. They're able to teach alternative interpretations of the origin and forms of life to those first devised by Charles Darwin.
So officially they're allowed to?
They're allowed to. They can't be stopped. The whole point, though, is that they won't be examined. They're not part of the state sanctioned curriculum. In the United States, you can't do that. But look, in Australia, I think we've managed this debate pretty well. In terms of other influences of Darwin in political life, I would have to, and also the arts, which you mentioned, I'd have to say that the influence in Australia is not direct. It's more in terms of, if you like, the cultural ambience. Most people in Australia do and have imbibed evolutionary theory in different sorts of ways. And certainly, if it has a leading edge, it's to, by and large, say that God is not involved or God was not involved in the creation of human life and that God is not necessary for it to be sustained because there are other explanations and other accounts that can be given of life. In terms of the arts, I wouldn't have thought that Darwin, in one sense, had particular influence. It seems to me the artists and the poets and people like that are the ones that want to resist the notion that we may just be the sum total of our physical surroundings and the chemicals that make up our bodies. From that point of view, I would say that most people's grasp of evolutionary theory is pretty weak. What they simply believe is that, you know, things get better. We become more advanced. It's not much more complicated than that. And in so being, I think there are a lot of misunderstandings which also arise.
All right, that leads to the final area which I want to explore with you, which is Darwin's influence on faith, on theology, on what we understand as God's nature and the way that he works in the world. Now, you've already stated at the outset of our chat today that you are somebody who holds to an evolutionary understanding of the world. You think it's actually a useful tool to understand how things have come about. Yet you're also a committed Christian. You direct a theological college. You are training Christian leaders. Now, how do you reconcile Darwin's ideas and the first chapters of Genesis, which account for God being the creator of the world rather than some sort of random chance idea?
Well, the first thing I'd want to say is that my Christian faith is informed by a number of sources. I look around at the world and draw certain inferences from what I can see, but I'm also a person who believes that God has revealed his character, his purpose, principally in the person of Jesus Christ, and that is the foremost, if you like, basis of the faith that I hold. What I would say in relation to evolutionary theory is this, that it helps us to understand the way in which I believe human life is now lived and how modern life forms have come to be. I think that God is active in the world through these natural processes and not in spite of them. That a God of great splendor and majesty can be seen through the evolution of this world. That we would get to the stage of understanding God, appreciating God, and even with theology, I think becoming more sophisticated in our understanding of the way in which God is active in the world and the significance of the redemptive death of Christ. But evolutionary theory doesn't tell us how life began. That is still an unknown. There have been many people positing ideas from there was this primordial sludge and there was a spark and life eventuated. We don't know where life first began. Life has to come from life, not from unlife or non-life. Therefore, that question still remains, the origin of life itself. Neither can evolutionary theory tell us anything about the destiny of the human species. There are some people who simply think we live, we die, and that's the end of us. But it doesn't, because it can't describe a world beyond physical manifestation. It can't tell us if there's anything beyond, because it can't measure it, it can't weigh it. And therefore, we need to see that evolutionary theory is quite limited in one sense of what it might say about the experience of being human. I don't see that the two things need to be in contradiction, and I do think when people say the battle between science and religion, that it is a real one. I think if we are looking for truth, we look for truth in different places, in different ways, with different tools. And it seems to me that this is God's world, and science in all its guises has helped us to understand more of it, its complexity. We didn't know anything about DNA until not all that long ago. And now, knowing something about DNA, about genetics, the way that molecules work, has helped us to see that life is, in fact, much more complicated than we thought 100 years ago. And therefore, I look forward to what science can help us understand about this world, because if it's God's world, we will see more of God as science reveals it to us.
We could, of course, talk about this for such a long time. As I said before, you know, we could have whole debates on the very nature of the Book of Genesis and the literature and the purpose of it and things like that. I want to run one thing past you with what we could call a theistic evolutionary understanding of the way God created the world, i.e., that God is the creator of the world, but he used evolutionary processes to actually do it. And that's the big question for me in my mind, is just the role of death, because it seems to be in the third chapter of Genesis that death is the result of the fall of humankind, of Adam and Eve, the rebellion, the sin, it comes. And so therefore, death comes in at that particular point. The evolutionary idea would suggest that death is actually then a tool, if it's, you know, used by God, it's a tool to then create life. It's kind of two opposing understandings of where death comes into the big picture story of how God created the world. Where do you take that idea?
Well, I suppose, again, I'd want to see that we can come at it, for instance, from the point of view of science, and we can come at it from the point of view of religion. From science, we'd say that, from what we can observe, that organisms have a lifespan. They live and then they die. They're not permanent, they're not immutable, they're not eternal, not in a physical sense. Alongside that, we could say, but what meaning do we apply to this? What meaning do we draw from the fact that we live and die? We have a span of years. It does seem to me that it's in the nature of things to live and to die, that we understand much of life's meaning comes from our understanding of birth and of death. Now, I suppose in time, it might be given to us to understand why the span of human years is whatever it is in Australia at the moment, 77, 78 for men and the early 80s for women. Why is it less? Why isn't it less, rather? Or why isn't it more? All of those kind of things are the things I think, Sheridan, I can't give you a good explanation for. It does seem to me, because I do want to live longer in this physical world, because there are bits about it that I like, there's a bit of me that says, well, this must be a fallen world because this experience ends. But if we do then think that death is a gateway to something else, something that is not then bordered by time, then it is the case that we ought not to kind of think, oh, this is a terrible thing that happens. We mightn't like it, but it's not to be feared. None of these things, I think, are very straightforward. The biblical writers, though, it seems to me, want to help us put some meaning on life that science isn't able to impart. The thing that I found in the last week as my book has come out and it's generated a little bit of controversy is that sometimes religion wants to say everything and exceed its brief, and sometimes science wants to say everything and exceed its brief. There is a proper domain in which each is competent to speak, and I think that too needs to be respected.
Okay, Tom, good to talk to you, and thanks for your time tonight.
Thanks, Sheridan.
Yeah, Dr. Tom Frame, director of the St. Mark's Theological Centre in Canberra, and the author of this latest book, Evolution in Antipodes.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit theopenhouse.net.au.